February 23rd, 2014, Indiana, Slovenia. And we're going to be discussing the qualities of a devotee. So one of the main questions that we ask, if we're smart, is why do I suffer? That's the question that an animal doesn't ask. You know, if a deer is running in the forest and falls into a hole and breaks her leg, she doesn't say, why me? But as a human being, whenever we suffer, we ask for what is the existential reason. We don't simply try to figure out, oh, well, I ate some bad food, therefore I got sick, or something like that. We think, why is this happening to me? What is the reason behind it? What is the ultimate
answer?
What is the ultimate existential cause? So, of course, this question was asked by the personality of Dharma. Dharma can be translated as religion, but also essence or being. And he said there's many, many reasons why we suffer. Suffering can be explained in many ways. But one way we can certainly explain suffering is that it comes from our bad qualities. It comes from our acting as something other than our ideal selves. So how is that? Well, we know about the law of karma, that what we experience is a result of what we do. Anybody can understand this on an immediate level. If you eat too much, your stomach hurts. Okay? If you go to your job and you yell at the boss and insult the boss, you get fired. If you treat the people in your life with kindness, they'll probably treat you with kindness. So we can all understand that there is some response to what we do. Of course, not all of that response is happening from this life, because sometimes in this life, a person is very cruel, but yet they're wealthy and so forth, and sometimes in this life a person is very kind and they're poor and sick and so many things. But it's not only reactions from this life, but it's also reactions from things in previous lives. But all of the bad reactions we're getting, poverty, sickness, difficulty in relationships, these are all ultimately coming from our own bad behavior. And even we can say that in general, the fact that we have a material body, the fact that we are in this world, because there's some general difficulty just being in the material world, that we are here also because of our lack of good qualities. Just like if you commit a crime and you go to jail, so you get a specific punishment, you're there for, you know, 10 years or something like that. But then there's certain miseries just because you're in jail. They're just general miseries. You have to be with other criminals. You're not with nice people anymore. Your environment's not so pleasant. Well, that's a general suffering. So even our general suffering, just having a material body, even if it's a beautiful body and healthy body, still having a material body in and of itself has some suffering. So all this is due to our bad qualities. But even on a non-karmic reincarnation level, how we experience life from moment to moment depends very much on our own qualities. We tend to think that our miseries come from something external to us. We think our miseries come from the weather. Right now it's cold and it's gray. There's just this big storm. Well, of course, I'm not happy because it's cold and gray. Or we think my miseries come from other people. Well, my husband isn't nice to me, my father isn't nice to me, my brother isn't nice to me, my boss isn't nice to me, my professor isn't nice to me. Whatever, it's some people in our life are not treating us the way that we want. Or on a level that's perhaps less apparently external, that my own body, my body and mind are also external to me. They are not me. So how my body behaves, how my mind behaves. But if we think about it for a moment, if inside I was peaceful and satisfied, then I wouldn't be disturbed by the things that I think are the source of my unhappiness. And we've all had experience of this. We've all had experience that the same situation one day can be very difficult, and that same situation on another day may not bother us much at all. Yes? We all have that experience. That a lot of it depends on how we are inside. What kind of a person we are inside. That it is possible to be peaceful and equipoise internally, and therefore not be disturbed by anything externally. If we could have that state all of the time, we simply would not suffer, even if externally we were suffering. So we can say our suffering is caused by our external situations, which are caused by our karma from other lives or in this life, and all of our bad karma comes from our bad qualities, so we can define our suffering in that way. But we can also say that even if I've done things in this life or in other lives which have brought on an external suffering, if internally, now, I am equipoised and peaceful, I will not experience my situation as suffering. Ultimately, whether or not a situation is suffering depends entirely on how I interpret that situation, not on the situation itself. Now you may say, well, how could that be true for something very extreme? You know, if somebody kidnaps you and ties you up. But even then, if one has the proper internal consciousness, then one simply does not experience suffering. One can experience happiness and peace in any situation. So this, our whether or not we have good qualities is ultimately dependent on which energy we take shelter of. We have to be under the shelter of some energy where none of us are independent. None of us are complete in and of ourselves. So the question is, do I take shelter of spiritual energy or material energy? And both of these energies are persons. So the spiritual energy, Mahatmanastumam Partadaivim Prakritim Ashritam. The great souls, the Mahatma, are under Ashrita, the shelter of the Daivim Prakriti. Prakriti is energy, Daiva is divine. So this divine energy, Daivim Prakriti, is Radharani. And then those who take shelter of the material energy are called Kam Ashrita. Again, Ashrita, shelter. Kama means lust. So Kam Ashrita is Durga. So in one sense they're the same person, but in a very different mood. In a very different mood. Radharani is in the mood of the very loving mother, and Durga is in the mood of the punishing mother. The mother who tells you, no, you can't play with your toys now, you have to go stand in the corner. And she's kind of a heavy mother. She has a trident and she rides on a tiger. So it depends what, yeah, pretty heavy mother. So it depends which energy we take shelter of. that determines whether or not we have good qualities or bad qualities. In one sense, all of our bad qualities are simply a misuse of our good qualities. There is no such thing, really, as a bad quality. It doesn't exist. It simply means we're taking something that's good and we're using it in the wrong way. There's nothing that's intrinsically, inherently evil. Everything is ultimately good. And just like we have this microphone. But if I take the microphone and I hit you on the head with it, right? So there's nothing wrong with the microphone. The microphone isn't evil. My hand isn't evil. You follow? Or if I take the microphone and I move it from one place to another. But if I hit you with it, then that's evil. But none of the ingredients, the microphone, my hand, the movement, none of that is in and of itself evil. So one can analyze that if you simply take a good quality, the good qualities are all part of the soul, and you use them under the shelter of Durga instead of the shelter of Radharani, then they are a source of pain. Then they are a source of pain. It's actually quite a simple thing. Another analogy we can give is if you want to go out of this room, there is a door. And next to the door, there is a wall. The wall is useful. Without the wall, the ceiling would fall down. But if you try to walk out of the room through the wall, then you will experience pain. There's nothing wrong with the wall, and there's nothing wrong with walking. But if you try to walk through the wall, it will be painful. So a lot of understanding how to avoid suffering and become happy is to discover our inherent good qualities and use them in the service of the internal energy. Use them in the way they're meant to be used. Now, we all have a sense that we have inherent, natural good qualities. Even people who do horrible activities in this world, they all have a sense that they really are somewhere underneath a good person. And sometimes the way it feels to me is that I have this Urmila that I live with, and then I have my ideal Urmila up there somewhere, you know, that I'm trying to achieve. I have the really nice person up there, full of all good qualities. And I'm trying to be her. She's my ideal self. But then I'm struggling with this far less than ideal self. Now, what is the nature of this ideal self? So it can be analyzed many ways. Arjuna asks Krishna twice in the Bhagavad Gita, what are the symptoms, what are the qualities of somebody who's realized, of someone who's enlightened? And I would suggest to you that this is something quite important to know. This is something quite important to know for at least two reasons. One reason is that you want to be able to gauge whether or not you are advancing in bhakti. Srila Prabhupada says that we should be able to judge our own advancement. We shouldn't have to get a certificate from somebody else. Just like if you eat a meal, you don't have to ask somebody, hey, did I eat? Did I eat enough? Am I satisfied? You feel yourself if you're satisfied. So in the same way, we should be able to tell, am I making advancement in bhakti? So we should know what are the symptoms. Then also, we are enjoined, especially by Rupa Goswami, that we are to choose our association and associate differently depending on someone else's advancement in bhakti. So therefore, we have to be able to gauge whether or not someone else is more advanced than us, the same as us, or less than us. Not to judge them and criticize them or envy them, but so we can properly choose our association. So therefore, it's extremely important to understand these lists of qualities. So one list is given in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita when Arjuna says to Krishna, How do I know who's enlightened? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? How does he walk? So then Krishna gives an explanation. Arjuna then asks again in the 14th chapter. He says, what are the symptoms of someone who's transcended the modes of material nature? And Krishna gives the answer in text 22 through 25. There are other places where Krishna lists the qualities of a devotee. He lists it in chapter 12, text 13 through 20. And then those are the main groups of verses. There's also in chapter 16, text 1 through 3, a list of the divine qualities. In chapter 13, text 8 through 12, there's a list of the qualities which enable one to get knowledge. So those are comprehensive lists. Then there's individual verses here and there throughout the Bhagavad Gita that explain, just like in the second chapter, Dehino Smin Yata Dehe Komaram Yovanam Dura Tata Dehantara Praktir Dhiras Tatra Namuyate. Dhira means a sober person, a realized person. So a realized person, Krishna says, is not disturbed by the change of body in this life and is not disturbed by the change of body at death. So that's a little explanation in one verse. In chapter 5, Krishna says, Vijavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hastani Suni Chaivas Vapakecha Pandita Samadarshina. There you have the word pandit, a learned person, a spiritually advanced person, doesn't discriminate on the basis of the body, sees various humans, a low-class human, a high-class human, an elephant, a dog, all equally. Now that doesn't mean that you invite the elephant in to dinner. And that doesn't mean you invite the criminal in to dinner either. But it means that you see everybody as soul. You don't have any enmity towards anyone. Now if we analyze all of these verses, so the end of the second chapter, end of the 14th chapter, end of the 12th chapter, beginning of the 16th chapter, beginning of the 13th chapter, and these other verses here and there in the Bhagavad Gita, we will find a very similar theme running through all of them. That's the theme of being neutral and equipoised, of being unaffected, of being having the same mood towards friends and enemies, having the mood of well-wishing and affection towards friends and enemies, of being unaffected by material miseries. So those lists are very significant in terms of gauging our advancement and being able to understand others' position. But these 26 qualities of a devotee give us some insight into our spiritual qualities, I think, in ways that those other lists do not. Because although the lists concentrate, almost entirely on equanimity. I should mention that besides this list of 26 qualities, which we'll be going over, there are also different lists. There's the list that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives of the 9 symptoms of bhava. And we find this in the Nectar of Devotion in chapter 17 or 18, I can't remember which one. And we also find it in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the 9 symptoms of bhava. So those are the symptoms of a very advanced devotee. There may be other places too that I can't remember right this moment. So these 26 qualities of a devotee are described in various places. If you look at your nice list, I'm so much like how intelligently this was printed out on one sheet of paper. A little tiny font. So these qualities of a devotee, we've listed the Sanskrit term. And then underneath the Sanskrit term, we've listed the different ways that Srila Prabhupada has translated this Sanskrit term in the different places where these qualities are mentioned. So these qualities are mentioned, you can see, in the 11th canto. They're also mentioned in the 5th canto, the 4th canto, 3rd canto, 2nd canto, and in Majjhalila chapter 22, when Chaitanya Prabhu is instructing Sanatana Goswami. Now, as I'm sure you'll notice as you quickly glance over the list, is that not all the 26 qualities are mentioned in all of those places. So in some places, a partial list is given, and in some cases, a complete list is given. Oh, I know where the other place is. So in addition, Rupa Goswami gives us another list of qualities of devotees. Is given by Rupa Goswami, interestingly enough, when he describes the qualities of Krishna. Rupa Goswami describes that Krishna has 64 qualities. Actually, Krishna has unlimited qualities, but he lists 64 qualities. And Rupa Goswami lists that, I think it's 55 of those 64 qualities are our qualities too. So we have most of the qualities of God. We don't have the qualities of God that he creates universes. We can't breathe out universes. That we don't have. But we have other qualities of Krishna, like we're very useful, we're very beautiful, we're very clever. In our original spiritual form, we have most of the qualities of God. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? And meditating on these qualities, which are our qualities, indicates to us why we all have that idealized self up there somewhere. You know, somewhere we have a consciousness of, an awareness of, the fact that I'm really not this body. And I really have nothing to do with this world. And I really don't have any bad qualities. Really, I'm a wonderful person. We all have that sense, a kind of intuition, that I know I'm a nice person. Because we are nice people. In fact, we're wonderful people. We're eternally wonderful people. We're eternally a soul who's full of all good qualities. And that hankering for that idealized self is our urge to awaken who we really are. Now, the unfortunate thing, and this is quite sad, is that although we really want to be our ideal self, yes? Yes, we disappoint ourselves over and over again that we are not our ideal self. Isn't it a fact? Yes. Every day, I mean for me at least, every day I disappoint myself in some way. I'll say, okay, I want to be like this kind of a person, and I find myself doing or saying, or on my best days, at least thinking, something that I really don't want to be, and I really don't want to do. So it seems very sad that although the entire source of all of my suffering is these bad qualities, and I don't want to suffer. Anybody who wants to suffer? No, we don't want to suffer. The problem is my bad qualities. And I don't even want to have these bad qualities. Yet I seem to be stuck. I seem to be stuck. And that our efforts to develop good qualities on our own always come up short. So we can take a class, we can read a book, we can make a plan, you know, that I'm going to be that ideal self. And it's true, you can progress, you can get closer to it and do more of being that ideal self, but we can't do it completely materially. It just doesn't work. Basically, as long as we're under the shelter of material energy, as long as we're under the shelter of Durga, we are not going to manifest our ideal qualities. Which is why Srila Prabhupada said, don't try to develop these qualities separate from Krishna consciousness. If one thinks, well, my Krishna consciousness over here is over here, and my working on my good qualities is over here, it will only be partially successful. It will only be partially successful. Why is that? Because our good qualities are coming from us, the soul, and they can only be fully realized when I realize myself. As long as I identify with matter, as long as I think I'm a material being, I will not fully be able to manifest my own qualities. It's just opposite. Does that make sense to everybody? My qualities ultimately come from my sense of identity. So as long as my primary identity is material, then I'm under the shelter of material energy, and I will simply not be able to 100% show my spiritual qualities. I have to show my spiritual qualities as part of my effort to come under the spiritual energy. And what it's not an on-off switch for most of us. I mean, it could be, but it's not generally. Generally, it's gradual. As I more and more identify with the spiritual, then I more and more and more manifest my true spiritual qualities. Now, there's another way to understand, other than just what energy one is under, another way to understand how one can manifest spiritual qualities is by looking at the first quality mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, text 1, of the divine persons. Does anyone know what the first quality Krishna mentions in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, text 1, when he gives the list of divine persons? Anybody have any idea? What is that first quality?
Pridelessness.
Oh, very good. Pridelessness is the quality, actually, it's the second quality mentioned in the list in the 13th chapter. So that's very, very good. And we could definitely say that humility and pride, it's listed as two, humility and pridelessness, which are defined slightly differently. And this humility, pridelessness, is the primary quality given in the 13th chapter. Yes? It's interesting you say tolerance, because tolerance seems to be the thread, being equipoised seems to be the thread that runs through all of these. Oh, lovely idea, yes. And if we have a... If we ever do it, this morning we talked about humility, and we talked a lot about how humility leads to gratefulness. If we do a seminar on humility, we talk about gratefulness as a symptom of humility. Now, the first one in the 16th chapter is fearlessness. It's fearlessness, which, by the way, is very related to humility, which is the first item, humility and pridelessness, which is the first item in the 13th chapter. And why fearlessness is so important as far as manifesting these divine qualities is a little bit of a mystery. And if one can understand this, one unlocks... I'm giving you two ways to unlock the whole treasure chest. The first way I talked about is coming under the shelter of the internal energy. The second way is understanding this fearlessness. And of course, those two ways are very intimately related to each other, but we're looking at them sort of from a different angle. The source of all of our bad qualities is fear. Yeah, if we just think about it for a moment, I'll assume that all of us are honest people. Hopefully there's no thieves. Hopefully we're all honest people. But... anybody here ready to say, I'm 100% honest? Anybody 100% honest? No. So if we think about, when are we dishonest? Under what circumstances are we dishonest? We will find that it's always a situation of fear. I'll be honest. And then when I become afraid of something, then I become dishonest. We think, oh, in this situation, if I'm honest, I'll lose something, or I won't gain something, or I won't be protected in some way. So then we cheat or we lie. Does that make sense? You can see it also with being kind. So again, I'm sure that all of us in this room are mostly kind people. We think about, when do I become mean? When do I act in an unkind manner with other people? It's always when I become afraid. I become afraid that I'll lose their love, or I'll become afraid that I'll lose something. I'm afraid that something I have will be lost, or something I need will not come if I'm kind. It's always fear. And it's a fear that my self-interest will be harmed. Now, if you don't believe me, pay attention in the next week as to any time you think, speak, or act in a way that's below your ideal. And you'll notice there's always a fear. There's some fear that's triggering it. It's a fear, again, that something I already have, I'll lose, or something that I don't yet have, I won't be able to have. I was once staying at the home of a family when the husband and wife got into an argument. And we were all going to the temple, and they had a little baby, and the wife said, "Will you please change the baby's diaper so we can go. And he says, well, I really don't want to. Can you change the baby's diaper? And she says, well, if you don't change the baby's diaper, I'm just going to leave the baby with you, and I'm just going to go by myself to the temple. And then, so she took the baby and put the baby in her husband's room, and then he took the baby and put the baby in the car. So then she stormed off and got in the car and drove away. And I turned to the husband and I said, you were angry. Why were you angry? What were you afraid of? So he thought for a while and he said, I was afraid that if I did what my wife said, I would lose my freedom. But I was afraid if I didn't do what my wife said, I would lose my relationship. And I was stuck because I wanted to keep both my freedom and my relationship. And I thought, well, that's very profound. You know, he felt stuck because she was just saying, you do it. She wasn't just saying, you know, would you please do it? You do it. I thought, well, if I do this, then I lose my dignity. I lose my freedom. But if I don't do it, my wife becomes angry at me and I damage my relationship. So he was nasty to her and she was nasty to him. You follow? Yes? So it all comes from some sort of fear. Now, this is a very sad thing to say and a hard thing to say, and I hope that I don't offend anybody. When we give up our good qualities whenever we're in a state of fear, what that means is, in one sense, I don't really have any good qualities. All I have is self-interest. I have self-interest and self-preservation. And if my self-interest is served by good qualities, I'll manifest good qualities. And when I think good qualities no longer serve my self-interest, I'll manifest bad qualities. That means I don't really have the good qualities, do I? Therefore, there's a statement in the Bhagavatam that in one sense, materialistic people don't really have any good qualities. Now, in another sense, you could say that we all have a different tipping point. So I'll be kind. And what makes me fearful? Where's that line of fear that when I cross it, I start becoming unkind? So you see that some people, that line is very low. All you have to do is look at them funny and they'll swear at you, yes? And for other people, it's very, very high. They can have so much difficulty in life before they become unkind. So in that way, we can talk about degrees of a good quality. How much fear do you have? And we can see that if it takes more and more and more to set off the fear, then you exhibit the good qualities more and more and more often. Do you follow that logic? So if I become fearful very easily, then I'm mostly going to be demonstrating bad qualities. If it's very difficult to make me fearful, I'm mostly going to be demonstrating good qualities. And if I had no fear line at all, then I'd only be demonstrating good qualities. Now, how do you have no fear line at all? How do you be always peaceful? How do you be always safe and secure? By understanding, and we come right back to understanding that I'm not this body, to understanding that I'm not of this world, that I can't be harmed by anything of this world, that nobody can harm me. I am a soul. I can't be harmed by any weapon. I can't even be harmed by lack. That I'm connected with Krishna. Krishna is described as Om Purnam Ada Purnamidam Purnat Purnat Udachite Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vasishite. That Krishna is complete, and from him complete comes, and even if you take the complete away from the complete, still he is complete. Infinity minus infinity is infinity. So when I feel connected with Krishna, I have infinitely everything that I need, and therefore what is there to be afraid of? I'm eternal. I have infinite love, I have infinite care, I have an infinite supply of everything that I need. What is the fear? Well, who can harm me? How can any situation harm me? There simply is no fear. Therefore, we have this nice song, Abhaya Charanana Vindale, that we become fearless at the lotus feet of the Lord. Therefore, someone who takes shelter of the spiritual energy and who connects with Krishna has no fear and therefore has all good qualities. So therefore, we might say that there's no point whatsoever in trying to develop these good qualities, but just try to become fearless and connected with Krishna, and all these good qualities will naturally manifest. That is very true. At the same time, making some effort within bhakti, not separate from bhakti, because an effort separate from bhakti will really not be fully fruitful, it will be frustrating. But making an effort as part of connecting with Krishna to manifest these good qualities for Krishna's pleasure helps us to become fearless and helps us to be under the shelter of the internal energy. So the example that I always give is just like Prabhupada also says, you don't need to make a separate effort to be a vegetarian. If you're a devotee of Krishna, you're automatically a vegetarian. You don't need to join a vegetarian society. You don't need to join the Hare Krishna movement and a vegetarian society. If you join the Hare Krishna movement, you're already automatically in a vegetarian society. Now that doesn't mean we don't make any effort to be a vegetarian. When we go to the shop, we don't just close our eyes and go through the shop pulling things into our basket and say, well, because I'm a devotee, I'll be automatically a vegetarian. But we carefully look at what we buy. We read the label. So the main thing we're offering to Krishna is not food or flowers. The main thing we're offering to Krishna is, of course, ourselves. So we want to look at our label, so to speak. We want to make sure that what we're offering to Krishna is nice. So because... Sure. It is cold in here, isn't it? Thank you. Look at this. What wonderful friends we have in our heart. Look at that. Oh, thank you so much. It really is cold. Thank you. Now I'm certainly going to be cold. I felt like a mannequin in a shop. All right. So as part of connecting with Krishna, as part of coming under the shelter of the internal energy, I want to make some effort to develop these qualities. And I'm going to emphasize again that just making an effort in and of itself is not going to do it. It has to be part of my bhakti. So what I thought we would do is I'd ask you to go through this list and pick out some of these qualities that you're interested to discuss. We don't have time. We have about 30, 35 minutes. So we don't have time to discuss all 26 qualities unless we discuss them very quickly. I'd rather take a few and get into them in depth. So if you could look at your list and then tell me which of these qualities you'd like us to discuss. Yes. Aniha, okay. So Aniha is described in several different ways, indifferent to material acquisitions, meek, humble, simple, free from worldly activities, and never endeavoring in ordinary worldly activities. So we talked about this already this morning to some extent. This is the sense that Krishna is going to give me what I need. Krishna is going to give me what I need, and everything I get is a gift. Everything I get is a gift. So materialistic people think, I am great, I am wonderful, and because I'm great and I'm wonderful, I deserve so many things. Right? I deserve so many things. And therefore, they make efforts to get so many things. Unfortunately, as soon as you think you deserve so many things, you don't enjoy them anymore. We are not capable of enjoying anything that we think we deserve. It just becomes ordinary. Do you understand? Does that make some sense? So I gave this example this morning. I'll give it again now. Sorry for those of you who were here this morning. So if you have 20 euros and you go to the store and you buy something and it's worth 20 euros, how do you feel? Okay. You have 20 euros, you go to the store, you buy something, and then your friend says, oh, I can buy that for 5 euros in another store. Well, how do you feel? Upset, right? You have 20 euros, you go to the store, you buy something, you find that it's worth 100 euros. How do you feel? Oh, very good. So the more we think we deserve something, the less we enjoy it. And the less we think we deserve something, the more we enjoy it. So this quality is that of being very simple. I can't make any claims. This quality is you make no claims. You don't claim some rights. You know, modern society, everybody claims rights. I have a right to this, I have a right to this, I have a right to this. And then one appreciates everything. If I have no claims, then I will appreciate breathing. Most of us think, of course I'm breathing, I deserve to breathe. One will appreciate sunshine. One starts to appreciate everything in life. And then one doesn't endeavor to get more things in life than one is destined. When it says you're never endeavoring, it doesn't mean that you just sit in your bed staring at the television set. What it means is that one does honest work for a reasonable number of hours, and whatever one gets, one is satisfied with. Actually, in this mood, anything one gets, one sees as a great blessing. One's life becomes filled with gratitude and appreciation. Even very, very small things like breathing and digestion, one feels it is a great blessing. One gives up all of one's claims. One says, I don't deserve anything in this world. Whatever God gives me, whatever Krishna gives me, is His great blessing. So this is a wonderful quality in which one can feel happy in all circumstances, and one is finding satisfaction within rather than for acquiring a lot of things. Okay, some other quality here. Remember, there's stuff on the back also. Yes?
How is it connected to Mridu? Amiha and Mridu? Is it connected?
Okay. Well, they're all connected in a sense, of course. So Mridu is mild, without a harsh mentality, always pleasing behavior, never harsh. So Mridu is more with our dealings with other living entities. That is an interesting quality. I don't think, whenever I've given this class, I don't think anyone ever asked me about this before, this one. So this is a very interesting one. Now, why are we harsh? We're harsh, generally speaking, because we think that I have to force others to do my will. Someone's not doing what I want them to do, we become harsh. Again, this comes from this fear that if somebody doesn't do what I want, that I'll suffer in some way. And harshness is almost always a way of forcing others. There, many, many years ago, I lived in a community of devotees, and there was one devotee lady who every once in a while, maybe about 10 times a year, would write a letter of complaint to someone else in the community, usually one of the leaders in the community. And the letter was full of very harsh language. And unfortunately, sometimes the letters went to me because I was running the school and two of her children were in the school. So I didn't get, thankfully, all of her letters, but I did get some of them. And what was very interesting is when you would read these letters, the immediate reaction would be to feel very emotionally disturbed. As soon as you read the letters, you would feel like all your emotions were sort of churning in a big storm. And after some time, I decided, what is it about her letters that have that effect? You know, why do her letters bring out, people would get very angry and very upset when they read her letters. And I realized that it was because she used very harsh language. She used what I would call very emotionally manipulative language. She wouldn't just say the facts. She wouldn't just say, you know, my daughter had too much homework for 3 days in a row and she couldn't get enough sleep. She wouldn't just give you a fact. She'd tell you that you had terrible character. She would attack your character. She would attack your motives. And after analyzing her letters, I can understand that most of us use harsh language whenever we feel very helpless and very frightened. That we feel we don't have the ordinary recourses. We're afraid that if I just put the facts on the table and I just speak with respect, then the other person can say no. And if they say no, then what will happen to me? So I'm trying to force the other person to say yes to something. So I want to make them feel bad. I want to make them feel scared. I want to make them feel angry. I want to put them in a situation where they're going to say, oh my God, I have to say yes. Now, of course, it doesn't generally have that effect. When somebody's very harsh with you, generally the effect is you tend to be harsh with them in return. And it's sort of, the whole thing sort of escalates and everybody's harsh with each other. By the way, that can go on life after life after life. Have this relationship of harshness and controlling with somebody. And people will do this not only in a one-on-one in their speech and letters, they'll do it, you know, toward the government. They have protests with the government and they become very harsh. You corrupt, terrible government. You don't care about any. Give us our demands now. You know, and if they get really harsh, they pull out guns and so forth. But, you know, what is the weapons? Whether it's a weapon like a gun or a knife or a bomb, or whether it's a weapon like it's still a weapon to try to force the other living entity to do my will. Whoa. This harshness, now this is generally, of course, there are sometimes when harshness is a sign of love and concern. There are sometimes, you know, if your little child picks up a knife, put that down, you idiot! May be appropriate. Okay. So we're not saying that harshness is always a sign of trying to force someone to do my will. But generally speaking. So this trying to force others to do my will is the exact opposite of spirituality. It's the exact opposite. And my dear friends, Krishna doesn't force ever. He simply doesn't force. Prabhupada says, what is the difference between rape and love? Krishna is not that kind of lover, Prabhupada says. He doesn't love you at the point of a gun. Love me, love me. There's that story of the Ramayana where Ravana kidnaps Sita. And he says to Sita, if you will not agree to be my wife, in 2 months, then I'll have my cooks cut you up and I'll eat you for breakfast. So why would you want to love somebody who's going to eat you for breakfast? How would you have like loving, affectionate feelings for such a person? It's going to make you less inclined to love them, not more inclined. So Krishna doesn't force. Krishna is reciprocating with our desires. He's fulfilling our desires. He doesn't force. And when we try to force somebody, it simply means that we don't trust Krishna. We don't trust that Krishna's taking care of me and he's going to give me everything I need. Bhoktaram yagatapasam sarvalokamahesharam suridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shanti michiti. Krishna is the controller. Sarva loka maheshwara. Sarva means all, loka means planets. Mahagrade, Ishwara, the controller. He's controlling everything. And suridam sarva bhutanam. Surid, rid means the heart. Su means very dear. Sarva means all again. Bhutanam, living entities. He's controlling everything and he's our very best friend. Why will he not give me everything that I need? Why do I have to try to force what I need or what I want from anybody? I don't. If I'm feeling some lack, I just simply have to connect better with Krishna. Now that doesn't necessarily mean Krishna's going to give us a lot of money and a lot of beauty in the world, but Krishna will have us be fulfilled from within. Those things are not going to fulfill us anyway, frankly. If they would, then all the beautiful, rich, famous people would be completely fulfilled. Are they all completely fulfilled? Are all the beautiful, rich, famous people, are they all totally happy?
Far from it.
Far from it, yes. Probably some of them are, but not 99% or 90% of the rich, famous, beautiful people are totally fulfilled. So when we say Krishna will fulfill all of our lacks, we don't necessarily mean that he'll give us, you know, everything we want in the material world, but we mean that internally we'll feel completely satisfied. Completely satisfied. Overflowing with satisfaction, dynamic satisfaction, not boring satisfaction. So if I'm in a situation where it appears that I can't get what I need, and it appears that some other person is holding the key to what I need, stop. Don't be harsh with that person. You can ask the person, excuse me, my dear person, who seems to be holding the key to the door behind which is what I need. Would you be willing to open the door for me? They say, no, I'm not willing to open the door for me. Then go to Krishna, my dear Krishna. I am feeling some lack because of illusion that I think I'm separate from you. Please let me realize that I am connected with you and that you are completely fulfilling my needs. Now, this can be very difficult when it's something that we think, I really, really, really need this, and I really need it now, and this person is the only one holding the key to the door. With practice, it gets easier. Sometimes it's harder than others. But there's no other living being ever that's holding the key to the door to what we want. That is just simply not true. The person who has the key to the door to what we want is God. And Krishna is perfectly capable of giving us everything we need, whether or not other people cooperate with what we want. Krishna is not dependent on having anyone in the world cooperate with us in order for us to feel completely satisfied. So the question then becomes, how else can I meet this need? How can I meet this need with Krishna? But you never force. I've had a lot of understanding in the last few years that any time we try to force anybody to do anything, I mean, sometimes you have to force little small children or animals, but other than that, anytime we try to force anyone to do anything, it's an indication of our fear and our lack of trust and faith and our lack of connection with Krishna. And it's definitely, that kind of behavior definitely entangles us in karma. And it makes us feel really quite unsatisfied. The more I'm harsh with others, the more unsatisfied that I feel. Even if I get what I want by being harsh with others, I'm not very happy when I get it. I don't feel much satisfaction. It doesn't give me that satisfaction that I want once I achieve it. Okay, another one. Someone else. Yes?
Meet the book.
Eating only as much as required to maintain body and soul together. A balanced eater eating austerely strictly controls his eating. So, again, why do we eat more than required? This is the same, it comes back down to the same thing that I feel incomplete. You know, eating is something we do to try to experience yoga, to try to experience connection. What am I eating? What are we eating? What is food? So food is all, even people who don't eat vegetarian food, but all of our food is, what is it coming from? It's all plants, right? Or it's milk. The milk comes from the cow that eats plants. And where do the plants get their energy? From the sun. The plants are transforming the sun into food. In addition to the sun, the plants also use water, and the plants also use some minerals from the earth. So when we're eating food, we're eating sunlight, water, and earth minerals. So what is sunlight? Krishna says, I am the light of the sun. Krishna says, Bhagavad-gita, I am the light of the sun. He says, I am the taste in water, and I am the fragrance of the earth. So really, when we are eating food, we are connecting with Krishna through his energy. It's also interesting to think about, since these bodies develop completely by eating food, then what are these bodies ultimately made of? These bodies are ultimately made also of sunlight, water, and minerals. That's it. Interesting, isn't it? That's what these bodies are made of. So ultimately, these bodies are Krishna's energy. Bhumir apanalok vayu kamano buddha evacha. Krishna says earth, water, fire, air, mind, intelligence, and ego. These are my bina prakrita, my separated energies. So when we're eating, really, we're connecting this body, which is simply transformed light, water, and minerals, with food that is transformed light, water, and minerals. What we are really looking for in food is a yoga connection. That's what we're really looking for when we eat. And the varieties of taste in the food. This is because there's a varieties of taste in Krishna. Krishna is called Akhila Rasa Mrita Murti. Rasa is taste. In Ayurveda, rasa means taste. It also means liquid. All tastes, all pleasures come from liquid. Yes? If you take, when I was a child in school, we would take a towel and we dried our tongue, and then you put salt and sugar on your tongue and you can't taste it. Without the liquid in your mouth, you can't taste anything. And the same, if our eyes get dried out, one time one of my eyes dried out on a long airplane ride, and then you can't see anything. Right, we need wax in our ears, and mucus in our nose, and oil in our skin, correct? All of our senses need some sort of liquid in order to experience pleasure. And Krishna is this liquid. Rasoham apsukantaya, he is the taste of water. He's the pleasure principle in all liquids. And there's varieties of rasas. So I'm sure most of us here have heard of the five primary rasas that we can have with Krishna. The awe and peace, the servant, the friend, the parent, the lover. There's also seven secondary rasas. Things like wonder and comedy and compassion. So the variety of tastes we get from food, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, pungent, and astringent, and then all the different kinds of textures and all the different kinds of fragrances, these are all varieties of Krishna's pleasure. And I am sure that on higher planets, they have a wider variety of tastes in their food than we have here. And ultimately, in the spiritual world, there's an infinite variety of tastes. It's not just sweet, salty, sour, bitter, pungent, and astringent. You know, and it's not just soft and creamy and crunchy. And you know, so we have a certain amount. There's food scientists who study these different qualities of food. But in the spiritual world, I'm sure there's unlimited qualities of food. So when we are enjoying food, we are really trying to connect with Krishna. So why do we eat too much food? Because I'm not connecting with Krishna spiritually. Very simple. If I'm connecting with Krishna on the spiritual level, then I would eat food only to maintain my bodily health and to relish how wonderful Krishna is in the food. Now, especially when we offer our food to Krishna, then we have double. So we have already that the taste in the food, the texture of the food, is really coming from Krishna's rasa. Even if you're a materialist, whatever pleasure you're getting from food, you're getting that pleasure from Krishna. And we can meditate on that. But then we offer food to Krishna. Krishna tastes it. And the direct personal taste of God is in that food. And when we're enjoying the taste of a pizza, we're enjoying the taste of Krishna's energies. But when we're enjoying a pizza offered to Krishna, we're enjoying the taste of God directly. What does God taste like? Oh, he has a flavor. Sure he does. What is the taste of God? Therefore, prasadam has a very different quality. And sometimes we're so dull we don't notice it, but every once in a while, if we're awake and alive and we're eating prasadam, we notice, wow, this food has a very different taste. I tell the story all the time that I was going to do a university program to give a class about Krishna consciousness, and before the program, one of the devotees was in the kitchen with me preparing some prasadam for the program, and she was making cookies. Do you call them biscuits here? Instead of cookies? Use the British term? Okay. In America, biscuits are not sweet. They're bread. All right, so she was making biscuit cookies. And they were very simple. They were really, really simple. They were made with butter, sugar, flour, sodium bicarb, and maybe some vanilla flavoring. And that was it. There was nothing else in those biscuits. That was it. I mean, I was in the kitchen and I saw her make them. And then they were offered to the deities, and we took them to this program. And it is my long-standing lament that I didn't get to eat any of them. Because after I gave the class, people were asking me questions. And all the biscuits were gone by the time I got over to the table. But as I was talking to people, at least 30, maybe 40 people out of 120 at that program came up to me or someone else and said, "What's in those cookies? Can I have the recipe?" And I thought, if I give you the recipe, you're going to be really disappointed. So why were they tasting something extraordinary? Because Krishna had eaten them. So if I'm relishing that, I will not overeat. Because just one taste of what is God is overwhelming. It's overwhelming and completely satisfying. So we should eat basically for those two reasons, for the healthy upkeep of the body and to feel that connection with Krishna, to experience that connection with Krishna. Unfortunately, it's only those who don't or aren't working to feel that connection with Krishna who tend to overeat, looking for that connection without feeling what's already there. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, but there was a scientific study. You always have to take scientific studies carefully because then there'll be another study that shows something else. But there was a scientific study that when people say a prayer before they eat, when they say a prayer over their food, they're not as likely to get fat. Isn't that interesting? Somehow it changes the way the food is digested even in your body. So conscious eating, meditative eating. What am I eating? I'm eating sunlight, water, and minerals, earth minerals. I'm eating dirt, water, and sun, which is incredible. That sun, water, and soil transforms into broccoli and apples and milk. And then I eat it and it changes into fingernails. Isn't that amazing? I mean, I think it's completely amazing. How can anybody be an atheist? I mean, seriously. Really? How can that happen by chance? I'd like to see some material scientist take sunlight, water, and soil and turn it into broccoli. You know? And then take the broccoli and turn it into bone, and hair, and eyeballs. That's amazing. So we can meditate like that when we're eating. What are we actually eating? And meditate on how it's all Krishna. Krishna is the light. Krishna is the water. Krishna is the soil. And when we're eating prasadam, we can meditate. Krishna tasted this. As the direct personal taste of God here. And then we eat as worship. We eat as love. We eat as real connection. Okay, another one. Remember, there's some on the back. Yes?
Gambira.
Gambira, okay. Being very grave. So being very grave means being serious. But serious doesn't mean that you're not also jolly. It doesn't mean you walk around like, "Whoa, I'm very grave all the time." But it means that one doesn't do things that are useless. One doesn't do useless time wasters. Of course, the devotees also have recreation. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the 6th chapter, that one who is balanced in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all pains by practice of the yoga system. And we see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his pastimes. So he and his devotees, they often have a lot of fun. Even when they're doing, you know, so-called ordinary activities, when they're cleaning the temple, they're cleaning the Gundicha temple for the arrival of Lord Jagannath, they did it as a game. You know, they all have these brooms, and they're having a contest who can get the bigger pile of dirt. And Lord Chaitanya got a pile of dirt bigger than everyone else's put together. And then when they were, after they finished getting, they swept twice, and then after they were finished sweeping, then they took buckets of water, and they were just throwing it, because the Gundicha temple is empty except with Jagannath there. So they're throwing the water at the walls. And then they had a bucket per grade, you know, where they're handing the buckets from the well. You know, they have a well and they're handing it down. And the last person's throwing the buckets at the walls and at the floors and at the ceiling. And then this water is coming together and making rivers coming out of the temple. And what they did was, as they didn't talk to each other the whole time, they just said Krishna. So if you wanted a broom, you just said Krishna, Krishna. If you wanted a bucket, you said Krishna, Krishna. And everybody was just saying Krishna, Krishna to each other. And pretty soon, while they were cleaning, they were also dancing. So everything that Krishna does is play. He doesn't. He's not like doing serious work. Krishna doesn't do any serious work at all, ever. He only plays. Even if he's doing something that appears very serious, like creating the material world, he does that while he's sleeping. Goes to sleep and he just breathes. The whole material world becomes created and destroyed as he takes one breath in his dream. So when we connect with Krishna, we also should find that everything is play. But we don't do anything that's useless. Great as we don't do anything useless. We don't waste our time. Prabhupada said, don't do frivolous sports. Not to do things, of course, gambling is a very frivolous sport. Not to do things that are just simply wasting of our human time and energy. That what we do, even our recreation, should be something that's bringing us closer to real joy. Okay, another. Yes, sir.
Akama.
Desireless, without material desire, free from material hankering, undisturbed by material desires. So one has no material desires because one is completely full. So, my dear friends, please, 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 never make the mistake of trying to kill or repress desires. Now, we need to repress some desires, sometimes temporarily. Otherwise, we wouldn't be civilized. Right? You see something nice in a store and you want it, you have to repress the desire temporarily because you don't have the money for it or whatever. But that should not be our method of dealing with desires. It may be some occasional temporary thing. When we say the devotees are desireless, it means because all of their desires are fulfilled, therefore they don't want anything. If you went to a very rich man like Bill Gates and said, what can I buy you? He would say nothing. Do you follow? You go to him and say, what can I buy you for your birthday? He'd say nothing. Whatever he wants to buy, he can already buy. He doesn't need you to buy him anything. So the devotee is experiencing that they already have everything they need, therefore they don't desire anything. We may get this or that for our service, but the devotee is desireless because they're full in Krishna. Because they're full in Krishna. The way to conquer material desires is to become full in Krishna. Do not try to kill desires. You will fail. You cannot kill desires. It is not possible. Please don't try to do it. The results are very bad. The results of trying to kill desires is you make your heart stone-like. Or you become very angry, or very bitter, or very frustrated. That is not a spiritual process. Please don't do that. So what we want to do is we want to substitute spiritual desires. I want to make Krishna smile. I want to please the devotees. I want to discover my real spiritual identity. So I'm not sure exactly when we scheduled it for, but I believe we're scheduling a class specifically on sex desire. It may be this group next weekend, and we'll look at this specifically in reference to sexual desires. Is that this group?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. This group next weekend. And we'll look specifically at that aspect of desire. But the principle is true for any desire. Do not try to kill desires. Very bad policy. First of all, you'll fail, and the side effects of your failure will be most distressing. So the pure devotees, the enlightened souls, are desireless, not because they kill desire, but because they're full. They're full. They feel, I already have everything I need, more than everything I need. All of my needs and my desires are already being met way, way, way beyond my expectations. That's what Dhruva Maharaj felt. He went to Vishnu for money and power, and then at a certain point he changed and he developed love for Vishnu. And at that point he said, oh, what I was looking for was just broken glass, but now I found a valuable jewel. And now those desires are now gone because I feel completely satisfied. All right, we will end here. So let us connect with Krishna, realize that we are a soul, come under the shelter of spiritual energy, in that way become fearless, and in that way develop these good qualities. And we can also, in addition, take some of these qualities of devotees from this list or from the other list that I mentioned and meditate on them and really ask Krishna, help me develop them in your service. Thank you. Hare Krishna.